Hello and welcome to not the Nashy Cast, but an episode of the Bloody Pit with your fabled co-host for the Nashy Cast. That would be one part me, Rod Barnett.
And then second part me, Troy Gwynn.
And together we make a hole, whole big pain in your ass. We are the two fellas going to talk to you this month, changing things up a little bit. I finally enticed Troy into doing an episode on Godzilla. And as a matter of fact, he has laid out a master plan for a small series of Bloody Pit podcasts focusing on the big G.
Yeah. When he says he had enticed me, what took long so long was not a lack of enthusiasm on my part, as you can quite imagine. Anybody who knows me knows I'm uber Godzilla fan, uber Kaiju fan. And so really what the holdup was we had to kind of come up with a direction, you know, a theme, because it's like we talked about when Rod and I were talking about this. We're talking about, unlike Paul Nashy, Godzilla has been much written about and much talked about, and there's probably hundreds of Godzilla podcasts out there. And so we were trying to figure out how can we come up with something that, you know, we know that people, just from some of the emails we've had through NashyCast, we know that there are people who are still discovering Godzilla today, you know, so they might find something that they would find interesting, but at the same time, not something that would just be retreading the same old ground, you know, for the seasoned Kaiju fan.
So we have settled upon a series of podcasts that we're going to label Controversial Kaiju.
Yes.
And tonight's episode will be the first in this series. This is where we're going to focus in on a few Godzilla movies that are, for one reason or another, controversial amongst fans. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Troy is a massive Godzilla fan. I count myself as a pretty large fan myself, but I do, in a lot of ways, still consider myself pretty much a neophyte next to the amount of information that you've absorbed over the years. I've done a fair amount of reading on the subject. I think I have seen all of the films now. There may still be one or two that I haven't seen, but I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Actually, no, that's not true. Mm-hmm. I definitely can think of the one that I know I have not seen. I have not seen King Kong versus Godzilla yet.
You're kidding.
No. I have seen bits and pieces of it over the years.
From beginning to end, yeah.
Yeah. So, actually intend to get my hands on that here fairly soon and finally sit down and watch it. Like I say, I've seen it in bits and pieces at different times over the years. Mm-hmm. Just have never done that thing where, you know, you sit down and you actually watch it from beginning to end and see the, you know, see the whole thing. Right. So, to me, that is still the one outlier, the one that I have not seen. Mm-hmm. Maybe one day we'll talk about that.
Well, we might. That certainly has its share of controversies too. I mean, really, in a lot of ways, most Godzilla films, to some degree, are, you know, can divide the fans, or have, you know, are discussed pretty heavily among Godzilla fandom. As far as there's only two or three that are kind of universally considered classics or universally considered bad, you know. And so my thought for this series that we're doing, when we say controversial, doesn't mean just controversial among like fans discussing whether it's good or bad, but also controversial in the sense that at the time, at least, that they were made, they were intense deviations from the Toho formula. You know, they stand out like a sore thumb as far as being, this is really different than what you would expect or what people were expecting from a Godzilla film at the time. Although in retrospect, we may find that some of them now over the years, you know, play a little better, and also maybe not seem as strange as the time they came out, you know, maybe a little more because what came, maybe they set the tone for what came, for films that came after them, people may not realize just how unusual they were at their time. So I think that you and I are a good team to do this because of the fact that, like you said, I am the uber fan, you know, the who grew up all my life with them. It's one of my favorite things, you know. It's one of my biggest areas of geekdom is, you know, is my love of Godzilla. As everybody's seen the shelves in my room covered with Godzilla figures. You like the films. You are a Godzilla fan. You are a Kaiju fan. Oh, yeah. But, again, you are still coming from it without maybe not the deep level of just living your whole life with it like I have. And so,
right.
I think it's good because one thing I want to say up front here is my approach to doing these kind of shows is I don't want people to assume that I'm coming into these to defend these films or to defend, you know, to take these films that a lot of people think are bad, like this particular one. If we're going to do one that most people think is bad, I may not be coming in necessarily to change your mind on the overall picture, but I'm also going to obviously, because I've lived my whole life with these films, there's a certain affection I have for even the worst of these films, you know, that probably keeps me, you know, that probably, and in other words, whereas you might not have that particular, you know, you enjoy them, but I guess what I'm saying is, like, think about you and your jungle films, like you've talked about before, you know.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah, that's true.
If a jungle, you know, if a jungle setting, all you got to do is see the jungle setting, and you're in your comfort zone, you know. And obviously,
it's true.
I've lived with these all my life so much to the point that even the worst of these, there's a certain affection that I'm going to have for them, and maybe they'll, you know, you might bring a perspective to it that I may still have slightly rose colored glasses with looking these things to a point, you know. And so I probably will be maybe more inclined to defend something in the film than maybe you would be. And so it might make us kind of an interesting, you know, team to see our take on, you know, how we
might agree. I agree. And I will say that I think that as far as I am a fan of Godzilla films.
Oh, yeah.
I can find enjoyment in even the ones that I don't think are very good. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I really love the vast majority of them. But I will say that there is a kind of standard way of, let's call it the standard trajectory of a giant monster fan.
Yeah.
And that is, when you're a kid, you love them because they're giant monsters. It's the same way little kids love dinosaurs.
Yeah,
it's the same kind of thing. It keys into that. Mm-hmm. Here's the big giant thing that can't be made to go to bed.
Essentially, right? That's it, yeah.
And so you go through that phase when you're a kid and you really love them. And you reach your snotty teenage years and you sneer at anything that can be laughed at because you don't want to appear to be too stupid or too uncool to like something that's so, silly.
Yeah.
And then most people, unfortunately, stay in that stage where it's Godzilla films, that's fucking stupid, right? But people who actually really enjoy this stuff and are just going through a standard phase move out of that and they realize, you know, actually, no, just like these other things that I enjoyed when I was a kid, you know, these things used to include comic books and monster movies and things like that, but now I guess it's going to be, you know, different things for different generations. But you slowly realize, no, you know what? I really still do enjoy this, and I can still get that same thrill that I got when I was 8 years old, when I'm 28, 38, 48, 58, whatever, and still really enjoy it.
Well, and then you start to realize the ones that you can still realize that, oh, that really was quality, this is really well made, this is a really well made one, and then you realize the ones that, like, okay, this one sucked. Pretty weak, yeah, but, you know, but hey, you know, it's like, doesn't mean you can't enjoy it.
Right.
You know, and I think, you know, it's kind of that same trajectory I think a lot of us hit with the Batman series, the original one, the Adam West.
Oh,
you know,
the TV
when
series,
I was a kid,
yeah.
Oh man, I was just so riveted to that, and it was high drama to me. You know, I mean, it's like the cliffhanger endings.
You're a kid,
and all the
villains, you
had no
idea.
I was just like, "What's going to happen? How's Batman going to?" You know, it was totally serious. Then after a few years, they started syndicating it when you're a teenager or a young adult,
and you realize
and
how,
like,
silly
Jesus,
this is.
God, how did I like this stuff? Then a few more years go by, and you see it, and you realize what a brilliant satire it is. You're like, God, this is one of those brilliant satires I've ever seen on TV. You know,
and it's so,
and you realize how brilliant Adam West's performance that just sells.
Oh, that dead, just, that
oh
deadpan,
and all the villains are great, but Adam West is just the one
that's
great
just
performances.
The '60s Batman TV series is one. You're right. You can follow the same trajectory with that show as the standard thing is for Godzilla films or giant monster movies or things of that nature, which is that realization if it's something done on more than one level, which the Batman TV series was,
then
you can come to it at a later time with different eyes and really catch something very different. And I think that is true also as we're talking about these the Godzilla movies. I think that there is something joyous into going back and I'll fess up. First time I saw the original Godzilla, the original film, of course, the American version, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, I just thought, ooh, giant monster destroying Japan. Ooh.
Yeah.
Thrilling.
Yeah.
But then as you get older, and especially after you see the original Japanese version, you realize just how much is being said with that movie about Japanese culture.
Yeah.
And various and sundry elements. I don't want to get into that first film because that's a whole podcast that could be done in depth and has been done. But there's a very different experience watching that movie as an adult than as a child. But I think you can enjoy them both ways. Yeah. And I do want to say that the reason I brought up the standard kind of fanboy trajectory of growing out of giant monster movies and then coming back to them later in life when you really decide, you know, I don't really give a fuck what everybody thinks about what I enjoy. Is I never really went through that.
I never went through a phase where I hid. I certainly never went through a phase where I wasn't up for watching a Godzilla movie, you know, for sure. You know, I mean, it's, yeah.
I mean, that's just it. I think that you stop kind of pushing it or talking about it.
Or going out of your way to collect. I mean, I think we did that with monster movies, you know. We've always loved monster movies, but there's that time where you start discovering some other things, and not just girls, but just other things in life, too, you know.
Girls are a wonderful distraction, and that's one that every little boy goes through. And it's natural, and usually those two things are keyed together.
And we've always been, you and I, I'm sure, at any point in our life, we were always into pop culture, but there was probably those years where it became, music became much more consuming, you know, than necessarily, we may have still, you know, caught a monster movie on TV, like, hey, it's cool, sit and watch it, but you might not necessarily have been going out and buying all the famous monsters and buying all the...
Right.
And then you reach that point in your life where you do start getting back, you know, where I think, I know so many people our age did, which is why in the last 20 years we had such a boom of books and magazines about old monster movies and about, you know, because all of us are hitting that age where we want to go back and we were able now to really connect again to that kind of kid inside of us.
Well, it's the desire to re-experience those things and see if they are what you remember them to be.
Yeah.
And that I mean, at least that's a good part of it is for me, and there's a lot of joy involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, folks. I'm going to try to structure this like a Nashie cast. We're going to take a quick break, and then we will come back and we will start our discussion of tonight's film. Maybe we should tell people.
Yeah, I guess we haven't actually revealed that yet, have we?
Tonight's film is known under many, many titles. We will go under the most recent title. Well, not the most recent, but. The title has been released on DVD under most recently here in the United States, which is All Monsters Attack from 1969, also known as Godzilla's Revenge, and also under a lot of other titles, which we'll talk about when we come back. But hang loose, people, and we will dive into a discussion of Godzilla and small children.
Yeah.
Are you tired of the same old pop culture podcast? Do you listen to those other podcasts and think to yourself, why don't they talk about the things I'm interested in? Hi, I'm Reverend Scott, and when I want to listen to a couple of guys with their appendages on the pulse of pop culture,
penis,
I listen to the Are You Serious podcast. Hear news about politics and religion where hosts Chris and Frank ask the tough questions.
If you woke up with a cock in your mouth, would you take it or leave it?
Yeah, exactly. How big is the cock?
You'll hear entertainment news about your favorite movies and TV shows, plus plain old wholesome discussion about the lives of Chris and Frank.
So, I mean, now I am, like, tattooed. It's weird. It's like I guess I should explain what I got.
Yeah.
It's three swastikas.
Each one interconnected to look like a smiley face.
And on my left arm is cock and balls. And you notice I looked at my right
arm when
I said
that. Character from an old Disney film.
It's a prequel to Song of the South.
Exactly.
No, I have,
it's called Song of the Cock and Balls.
It sounds like this.
So when you think pop culture podcast, remember this.
What's that thing between the dick and the asshole?
The Are You Serious Podcast on iTunes or areyouseriouspodcast.com.
Cried just like that did. Gee, that's pretty exciting. You rising like that from monsters?
Gosh.
All right, folks, I'm going to start our discussion of tonight's film, All Monsters Attack, from 1969, by asking you a simple question, Mr. Troy Gwynn. 1969, this film was released in that year.
Yes.
That is exactly 15 years after the release of the original, very first Godzilla film, 1954.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that at the 15-year mark, suddenly Toho was making a greatest hits film?
You could certainly put it that way. I mean, yes, you could certainly... I think it was definitely a point of transition for Toho. I mean, it was definitely the main things going on with Toho were that all the key guiding lights of you know, the Godzilla series, you know, which had basically been, you know, producer Tomoyuki Tanaka, the soundtrack, you know, the score, you know, musical director, which is Akira Fukube, the director Ishiro Honda, and your special effects supervisor, who is Eiji Tsuburaya. Mm-hmm. You know, those were kind of like, they always call them the Mount Rushmore of Godzilla films, those four men, you know, there. At the time that Godzilla's Revenge was made, you know, it was the 10th in the series.
Right.
The series is now with the latest, newest Godzilla film, an American Godzilla film, has reached 29. So it's one of the longest ongoing series in film history now. It was the 10th film in 15 years. And Eiji Tsuburaya had started his own production company, and he was really kind of devoting...
The special effects man.
Yes, that's the special effects man. He had started Tsuburaya Productions, and he had... really was focusing all his time and energy really more into that, and he was still loaning his men and his talents to Toho, you know, but he was interested in doing his own television productions and own product, which of course eventually is where Ultraman and the whole Ultraman series came from.
Right.
But at the time that they were getting to make, or that they were getting ready to make Godzilla's Revenge, or to make a 10th Godzilla film, he not only didn't really have the time to direct the special effects or to supervise that, but he also was beginning to be very ill, and in fact, he only lived a few weeks after Godzilla's Revenge was released. But he essentially had nothing to do with Godzilla's Revenge or All Monsters Attack. Ishiro Honda, the director, really ended up directing most of the special effects sequences himself, which is something that never happened before. Usually it was Ishiro Honda handled all the human action, and Eiji Tsuburaya and his team directed, you know, and handled all the special effects production scenes. So in this case, Ishiro Honda had to pretty much do it all. And another thing, too, is, you know, it's true that the series had definitely started to slack off in its profits. You know, it was still fairly successful, but their last couple of films had not been drawing the profits that they had been used to with Godzilla, the kind of golden run there, you know.
Yeah.
So one thing that was interesting that happened was they were actually feeling a little bit of heat from a certain spinning turtle with a certain turtle that had a certain affection for young
children.
Yes, uh-huh.
The first Gamera film from, was it Dai?
Dai, yeah. With the
that
name.
Came out in 1966,
I think.
1966, I believe.
66. And so what had happened was, you know, the first three Gamera films had pretty high production values, you know,
yeah.
and two of the three centered around, had a small child as its main character. So Gamera films were really appealing to the children, but the fourth Gamera film started a trend among the fourth through the seventh Gamera films just increasingly used more and more stock footage. I mean, they come up with all sorts of plot devices to pad out the films in a big chunk of stock footage from the first three films. And the fourth Gamera film was the first one to do that. So basically, you know, people always talk about Gamera as being the poor man's Godzilla, you know, but actually that series was really getting Toho's attention with the fact that how little they were spending on those movies, how much they were geared towards children, and how much use they were making of previous footage. And so those footage, that I think, you know, that kind of, I think, went in more into why this film, when you say greatest hits, I assume you're referring to all the stock footage.
I'm referring to the fact that almost all of the monster battles, not quite all, but most of them are taken from previous films.
They are. And that's something that, you know, that's one of the aspects that's most heavily discussed with this film, and the reason why, you know, it's considered one of the worst, if not the worst, films in the Godzilla series. Let's just go ahead and say that right now. I don't know if you can call it a controversial film in that the film has so few defenders. You know, there are some out there. You
there
know,
are
I have
some,
come
yeah.
across some, but for the most part, most people do consider it the worst Godzilla film. And one of the things that certainly people point to as one of its major weaknesses is that it uses, you know, 90% of the monster footage is stock footage. But what they do is they use footage from really two films mostly, which is Godzilla vs. the Sea Monster and Son of Godzilla. These a little bit from Destroy All Monsters, but essentially it's those three films, and that's considered, and yeah, and there's really very little actual new Godzilla footage. So yeah, I don't think their approach to it was, you know, was a I think at that time, they're probably, most of the Godzilla films had not yet been starting to be shown on TV, and so they probably felt like they could show this kind of stuff. And it wouldn't necessarily be something that people had just seen the day before or something, but I think their approach was more economical than it was necessarily to celebrate these past achievements, because I think if they were doing that, they would have gone back to their better films, you know, the first
run
of
first, from
yeah.
them, yeah.
Hi, son, where are you going? Home?
Hi, Dad.
I gotta work tonight. You be good till your mother gets home.
Okay, Dad.
All right, well, let's synopsize the film, give everybody an idea. I'm hoping that if you have seen, if you're listening to this podcast, we're hoping that you've seen the film already, or that you are just not interested in seeing it and want to hear us babble about it, whichever works. But for those who haven't seen it in a long time, here's a quick run through of the basic plot line. Ichiro is a highly imaginative but lonely little boy growing up in urban Japan. Actually, the film was shot in Kawasaki, I believe. Mm-hmm. Every day he comes home to his empty apartment while his father is at work as a railroad worker. He runs trains. And his mother is a restaurant worker. She seems to work in a tea house.
Mm-hmm.
So he is basically a latchkey child,
yep.
I think would be the best way to put it. So, and if you're not aware of what a latchkey child is, it's just a child usually in an urban environment, if not always in an urban environment, who may be a little too young to be at home alone, but by the unfortunate happenstance of both of his parents having to work or being the child of a single parent, he has to spend the first couple of hours after school at home alone. Hence, latchkey child. You have to have a key to let yourself in. There you go. So that's what Ichiro is. We briefly see his father as Ichiro walks home from school, as we're introduced to him. And we also briefly see his mother when he talks to her on the phone while she's at work. And she's apologizing that she's going to have to stay a little bit later at work than normal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the neater things about this movie is that it takes place over the course of roughly a day, about 24 hours. So we join Ichiro a day after school as he walks home.
Mm-hmm.
And we are introduced to the fact that his only real friend is a toy maker who lives in the same building with him, who kind of serves as a surrogate father in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And he does have one other little girl who, one little other friend who's a young girl named Shakiko, maybe?
Shakiko,
or something like that.
You're right there, yeah.
Now, she's not that much of a friend because, man, does she bail quick when she goes down.
Oh, yeah.
But the only other kids around are...
Yeah, her main things just kind of consist of, you shouldn't go there, you shouldn't do that.
There. She's basically just a little damn nag. But the only other kids we see in the film are this gang of kids led by a bully named Gabra.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to escape his loneliness, Ichiro imagines that he is on Monster Island, where he befriends Minya, the son of Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
And it is through his daydreams that he watches Godzilla and Minya fight other monsters, including one that is also named Gabra, who is just as bad a bully as the one he is tormented by in real life.
Mm-hmm.
It is through these daydreams that he learns it's okay to fight back and to face his fears. And I'm going to leave out one... Well, all right. There's also a subplot in which there's a couple of bumbling bank robbers...
Bumbling is the word, yeah.
That Ichiro stumbles across and has a little adventure with. And boy, am I going to bitch about that plot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This film I originally saw on video cassette under the Godzilla's Revenge title.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a good videotape. I think it came out in the early 90s. It was widescreen, so I was able to see the whole image.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really nice. It was one of the first Godzilla films I got to see widescreen, and I fucking hated it.
Mm-hmm.
Pissed me off.
Mm-hmm.
First viewing of Godzilla's Revenge, I thought, this is a piece of shit. I did not give a fuck about seeing some stupid little kid.
Right.
Whine, moan, and complain, and then finally stand up to a bully.
Mm-hmm. It's like watching an after-school special or something.
I know. It's like an after-school special with Godzilla interspersed.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that I've come to love this film, because I have not.
Right.
I do not think it is a good film.
Mm-hmm.
But it has its joys. And as an adult, I can, and much the way we were talking about when we first opened the podcast here, I can admire elements of the film, while I still think that it is easily one of the crappiest Godzilla films that exists.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is my... That's like point. Now, Troy, counterpoint.
Okay, well, I guess that's probably the best place to start is where I first saw this film and kind of put my... where I came to it in perspective. Because I saw this film... when I was very, very young. In fact, I probably saw it I don't know the exact year, but it had to be early 70s because I saw it on the creature feature. We've heard us talk about this before right. on our Nashi cast, Dan Fisher. Oh, by the way, happy 50th birthday to Dan Fisher, our man our man in the field, Dan. Yes, happy 50th.
His recent birthday.
Yes, yes. And anyway, Dan has done some segments on our Nashi cast program, and he mentioned Sir Cecil Creep, who was our Nashville horror host growing up, who hosted Creature Feature, which was on late on Friday nights, and saw many great films there. And it's where I first saw Godzilla's Revenge. And so to put this in perspective, why the film was a revelation for me, because, okay, first of all, the only films that I had seen, I had basically, you know, the only films they showed on television up to that point, the only Godzilla films I'd seen on television, were the ones where Godzilla was the bad guy. You know, the villainous okay. monster, you know, either the only monster stomping the city or basically the monster who is fighting either King Kong or Mothra, but he's still in the villain role, you know.
Right.
And so I was used to these, but I immediately gravitated towards, I just loved Godzilla from the first, you know, but I just had to keep watching him always get beat and killed, you know, and always end up, you know, meeting his demise. And I think it's, here's all you need to know about what I was destined to be a Godzilla fan is because I actually would, when I was real little and these films would come on TV, I would actually cry when Godzilla would die, you know, at the end of, you know. Now, I always sympathize with the monsters because, you know, if you're destined to be a monster yeah. kid, you know, any monster kid, that's part of what makes you a monster kid as you grow up is because you were the one, you sympathized with most of the monsters, maybe not Dracula, but you definitely always felt sorry for a creature from the Black Lagoon. You always felt sorry for yeah. Frankenstein monster, you know, you identified with King Kong and all that. But so I did all that, but Godzilla was the only one I ever watched that I actually got really, really upset and actually cried, you know, when he met his end, you know, at the end of the films when I was real little. So basically, if they ever make a documentary about my life, they're going to have to call it The Man Who Cried When Godzilla Died is what they'll have to call it. So. And I'm sure everybody's just lining up to make a documentary about Troy Gwynn. But anyway.
On a related subject, it turns out that quite honestly, I may be the name of the documentary about my life yeah. would be The Man Who Cried Every Time He Heard Any Version of Life on Mars by David Bowie.
Oh, well, hey,
It doesn't matter who covers that song. Yeah. If I hear that song, I weep openly at all times. It's pathetic, is it not?
I like that. That's a good choice. A great song, then. Yeah. So
the man who weeps at Life on Mars.
That's pretty good. Here's what I'm saying. So, seeing Godzilla's Revenge, you know, first of all, you have to remember that I had not seen any of the films that it drew the stock footage from. So there was no part of me.
Oh, okay. So to you, this was all new material.
It was all new. The first time I saw it, I had not seen any of that other footage. Now, also, being just the way, at least at that time, and I don't know if kids can still do this, but I know being a kid at that age, just like there's so many films now that I look and see how bad the special effects were. Boy, they didn't look bad to me when I was, you know, when I was little. I was totally wrapped up. I mean, I thought the monster in Reptilicus was badass, you know, and then I see it now, I'm just like, oh, Jesus Christ, how did I like it? How did I, was that, you know? And so,
you know. Okay, hold on. We have to pause. Yeah, okay. We have to pause because, honestly, I have to absorb the fact that there was a time in anyone's life
that they thought that the monster,
monster in Reptilicus was badass.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I was totally convinced, man. You know, Dinosaurus is another one. I used to love when Dinosaurus would come on, you know, and I see it now and I'm just like, God, how did those monsters look so awesome to me when
okay,
I was, you know.
Okay.
So what I'm getting at with that is that people talk about how distracting it is that the Godzilla costume changes from scene to scene because they're using.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And in fact, one of the costumes is probably the worst one that Godzilla ever had, the worst Godzilla costume that was just terrible. But
as a kid, you didn't notice that.
I made no distinction.
That zooms by.
So think about how killer the movie is because, you know, you think about it, it's pretty action-packed. Now, unfortunately, the action is action that's already taken place in, you know, I mean, I'm talking about the kaiju action is. But not for the age I was. So it's not the kind of affection that I've carried with me enough that I don't see the major, major problems or that the film holds up in that respect.
Right.
But I just wanted to put in perspective why the first time for me was why it was such an opposite. I mean, I you know, to see Godzilla, and to see Godzilla as the good guy, to see Godzilla.
Right.
Here, it also, interesting enough, didn't bother me at all that it's all a dream, see, that it's that everything happens.
That everything's in his imagination.
That didn't bother me either, you know. I was just thrilled to be seeing a Godzilla film where Godzilla wins and he's like the hero, you know.
Here's the difference is that I didn't see it until I was an adult.
Yeah, sure.
And
yeah.
You saw it when you were a kid.
No, it's a major difference. I think it would affect anybody differently like that. And having said that, it was years later before because they only showed it that one. This was not a film that continued to pop up on TV in the years following. I mean, I didn't see it again 2 years later. And, you know, by the time I saw it again, I probably was at least a teenager. And, you know, and certainly by that point could already begin to, you know, see the problems in it or just not be able to connect to a film that is made for children. And it's the first Godzilla film that really was intentionally made for children. But I think that Toho was beginning to see how many kids were identifying with Godzilla, how much of his fan base were young children. But this was the first film in the series that was really their target audience.
Well, I think that there's that hysterical line I think Michael Weldon of Psychotronic had to say about this movie, which is Godzilla's Revenge is made for 6-year-olds. Which is odd, considering generally Godzilla films are made for 10-year-olds.
Well, for the
10-year-old in all of us.
Yeah, but sure,
I think,
sure,
unfortunately, right. Dropping it down to the six-year age is the thing that drives us insane when we try to watch this as an adult.
Yeah. But, well, I've said the thing about the Star Wars series is the first two Star Wars films, and by that I mean, of course, Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, you know, were made for the kid in all of us, and then the rest of them were made for kids, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, there's your distinction there, you know.
Exactly.
But, so I guess the thing is, you almost have to view this film, think of it in terms of maybe in two different ways, is think about it first, is it a good film? And then second, is it a good film for kids, you know? How does it work as a kid's film, you know? And I think this film is the last one, Godzilla film, that has really had any of, still had, like I said, it's still directed by Eiichiro Honda. I mean, it was the last Godzilla film he did until he stopped doing them for about 5 years, and then he did the final one of the original run of Godzilla films.
Which was
Terror of Mechagodzilla.
Okay.
But this was the last film he directed. Kira Fukube was no longer doing the music. As I said before, Eiji Tsuburaya was no longer doing the effects.
Yeah.
And it's the last one that's just peppered with the great Toho stock company of actors, because of the way that
the actors in this, you spot in a dozen different Godzilla films. That's true.
And they talk about the way that it worked in Toho's system there in those days. Literally, the actors would show up to the studio like it was a day at work and just be given parts. Like if someone showed up and they didn't have something they're already working on, they just hang around until. So that's why you'll see one actor who has a major part in one Toho fantasy film or Toho production, and then in something like this, he may only have like one scene because they just showed up and waited to be given. And that's part of a great joy of those first 10 Godzilla films for me, is just all those same faces and the familiar faces popping up and that just great company of actors. By the next film and from then on, the rest of the original run of Godzilla films, you don't really see any of those actors anymore, and it's because that was kind of the end of the Toho, their film system. TV was taking over. All the actors were going to TV, or they were pulling the actors, or they were going to, in fewer productions, higher productions, and Toho was having to pull more actors from television. But you don't see the actual last Toho fantasy film that's really the end of that period, is Space Amoeba, which is one that Toho did after this, after Godzilla's Revenge. It's not a Godzilla movie. Space Amoeba, which is also called Yogg Monster from Space, that is really the last one of the whole run of Toho original fantasy films that had...
By that crew
and had those same actors. It's kind of the end of Toho's golden age is what they call it.
Okay.
But
okay.
For all intents and purposes, this was definitely the Godzilla film that kind of signals that transition there. You know, the last time you'll see these people, and also again because they just, you know, the budgets were about to go way down. And the films, even if the rest of them, they weren't all aimed for kids from then on, really, the next...
But they have a different tone.
They very much
this,
do.
Yeah.
The next three Godzilla films after this one, all were still aimed at kids, and then you kind of pick up with those last two Mechagodzilla films, go more for an adult tone again, but at that point it was still just, that was the tail end of, you know, it was dying out, you know, the series that was dying out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they kind of pushed the... these movies are for kids thing a little too far with in 72 and 73 with Godzilla versus Gigan and Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla. There's no way to really get your adult joy jollies out of those movies. They're really kind of silly. Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla 74 and then Terror Mechagodzilla in 75, it did. I mean, regardless of what you think about those particular films, and those can be debated back and forth. You're right. They did try to rein it back in before they just gave up.
to hell with this.
So yeah.
Well, I think that one thing that's interesting to me about the perception of Godzilla films. Okay, I think and it's kind of one reason why this film, as bad as it is, and as many people as don't like it, it's one of the films that I think that a lot of people probably did see when they were young, and a lot of people did. I think it colors a lot of what people's perception of what the Godzilla series was. Because something that's interesting, a lot of people might surprise know, is a lot of people, when they do think of Godzilla films, they one of the things they always throw out there is, yeah, there's always the little boy that's waving goodbye to Godzilla. There's always the little boys. That's the same, you know, the main character or there are actually only three Godzilla films in the entire series that feature a child as the main character. You know, that may surprise a lot of people that three of the 29 films, that's not many.
No.
But
it's burned into our brain.
Exactly.
Now.
And I think the Gamera films add a lot to that, too. Yeah. People also saw the Gamera films in their memory, unless they're kaiju fans that keep up with it. In their memory, they'll go back and they'll mix the two.
Yeah.
And so they just think of them always like, oh, those Godzilla, those giant Japanese giant monster films that always have the little kid as the main. Yeah. You know, that's really not necessarily the case, you know. But it's interesting that those films really did kind of damn the rest of the Godzilla series to having that perception, you know,
and having both
those perceptions that they're made for children, all made for little children, and that they all feature a child as the main actor. But really, for the most part, most of the Godzilla films were trying to appeal to an entire audience. You know, they had adult themes in them as well. But.
Which I think, you know, if you get to the point where you actually revisit the films as an adult, you pick up on.
I mean, let's
not beat around the bush. Most film fans, regardless of what they think of the horror genre or monster genre or anything of that nature, will say flat out that Godzilla is a really great film. The original film is a great movie. I mean, you know, it's for God's sake. I mean, it's been handled by the Criterion Collection. So to a large degree, the critics have spoken. You know,
they will.
60 years after the fact, look, this is where this film stands. This is a classic of the genre, and as a matter of fact, a classic of its time, and needs to be recognized as such.
Yeah.
It's spoken of in the same breath as The Seven Samurai.
Right, it's considered one of the great Japanese films. Yeah,
exactly. So there's very little question about naming that movie as a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
But you move away from that, and immediately you're into what a lot of people think is nothing but Kiddie Land territory.
Yeah,
that's all that they think that those films are.
Mm. They I know it always drove me nuts. Even when the Godzilla films in the 90s that you know had so much more improved, where they really put the great special effects in. I would read the reviews that come out. You pretty much assume the critic had not even seen the movie. He almost went into his file and dug out an old Godzilla review that said, once again, men in rubber suits step on matchstick, buildings. And totally ignoring how much craftsmanship went into making these films and making these cities and making these, these monsters and design them, and how much they varied depending on how much money and how much time Toho would put into them. How, you have really high points of incredible quality special effects, and then you have incredible low points, too, of really bad stuff to watch, And it varies a lot, but it a lot of times doesn't get that credit for having those ups and downs, those highs and lows.
Well, let's talk about the things in this film, in this particular film, that I think can appeal to an adult. Let me say right out front that I think that Godzilla's Revenge, a.k.a. All Monsters Attack, is a good children's film, but a shitty Godzilla film.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how I look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a kid's movie, it has... it's short. It's 1 hour and 9 minutes long.
Right.
Therefore, it definitely does not overstay its welcome.
Right.
It keeps its focus on a kid who is actually played by a child actor who is actually fun to watch.
He is.
Not obnoxious.
That's right.
The character isn't precocious, therefore irritating.
Right.
And therefore, the character and the actor, the little actor playing him, is they're a good combination, and they're not off-putting in the way that a lot of children's characters in later movies of any type really, and movies that came out before it as well. Often child characters in movies are the kind of thing that make you grit your teeth until you ground them down to dust. They're terrible.
Right.
Not so with this kid, and that's a big plus
that
for
a
film where the main character is a small child. So.
Yeah,
that's
he does a pretty good job of conveying his kind of isolation and his sort of loneliness, he projects that very well, without playing to the cheap seats,
Without the horrible thing that so many child actors are taught to fall back on, which is to overact, to over-emote, to overdo everything, and he doesn't. He's very, and I have to think that has to have something to do with the director. I think Honda was just a good director, and he handled actors well to begin with, and you can see that in any of these other movies, and you can also see that in the interviews that you can read with people who worked with him over the years as well. Mm-hmm. He communicated well, and I would just have to assume that he was able to draw a really good performance out of this kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, I think it's a good children's movie. Let me explain that statement.
Sure, yeah.
It has a really good lesson to be taught, even if I think we can joke around with the ending of the film and exactly what lesson this kid took from the sequence of events over the course of a day. That's something for a later discussion.
Yeah,
but I think that the basic idea, which is no matter how introverted or introspective a child you may be, and no matter how alienated you may feel from the world around you, you have to stand up for yourself, and you may actually have to be braver than you think you can be.
Mm-hmm.
And this film carries that message. It's not the first film to carry that message. It's not the first after school special to carry that message.
Right.
But it's a good message, and it's conveyed well. And because of the central performance, it's effective.
Yeah.
Now, it's a shitty Godzilla film because, A, there is no Godzilla in the movie.
Right, right, sure.
It's all in the imagination. As far as we can tell from this movie takes place in the real world.
Yeah.
In our world.
Right, right.
And all the Godzilla stuff is just him imagining his, you know, fanciful, you know, Doctor Strange-style astral projection visits to Monster Island. So what we have here is a lot of, you know, we've already talked about it all being, the vast majority of it being footage from previous films. And that's not the worst of it to me. The worst of it is that it's strung together just to, well, let's just say I've never been a big fan of Mina to begin with, the whole Son of Godzilla thing.
Yeah.
It's been a long time since I've been able to make myself sit through Son of Godzilla because I'm not a big fan of it either. So that character kind of irritates me. And in this film, it irritates me even further because he's talking.
Yeah.
And he's talking back and forth with this kid. And as nuanced and as good a performance as that little kid gives, there's almost no way to give a good performance as Mina in that little outfit.
It's
just not possible.
Yeah.
So I don't like the Mina character. I don't like the fact that, and this is a big mistake, and I've talked about this before. I think it's a big mistake to think that kids need a childlike character to identify with in a story. They don't.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, I never identified with a damn kid. I identified with Batman.
Yeah, right, right. Okay? You didn't need Batman.
That's who I wanted to be with.
Yeah.
That's who I wanted to be. I wanted to be Batman. I wanted to be Superman. I wanted to be Spider-Man. Yeah. I did not want to be stupid freaking sidekick.
And it was one of the worst trends of Saturday morning cartoons or any kind of animation through the 70s was that every single show... Of course, we know, we might as well say the famous Godzuki, you know, we might as well say every single show had to have the comic character that they thought kids would,
had to have the obnoxious character like Scrappy Doo.
Yeah, I know.
We don't need a kid version of these characters.
No.
The reason we're watching this show is because we like these characters. And in some way, if you're a little kid and you're watching these characters, that means you, to some degree, identify with them. I don't need a little kid character to identify with. So to have the little kid, it's almost as if you're being told, you're the little kid, and you're not going to identify with Godzilla, which we all know is BS.
Right, right.
You're of course going to identify. Yeah. That's who you're hero worshiping from afar. Mm-hmm. He's the big dinosaur that can crush anyone. We don't need Son of Godzilla. It's a waste of time, and it is a misstep that is so often made. It's still being made today in some stories and in some television series and things of that nature. You don't need it. I almost want to say there's a reason He-Man never had a son. Well, mainly because he probably is gay, but that's beside the point. I mean, that's what it boils down to. I'm not really sure what his relationship with that giant cat was, but not sure. But here's the thing. That's one of the more irritating things is that the lessons the kid learns is because he watches Mina be, quote unquote, parented or tough loved or whatever you want to call it.
That's
into kicking the crap out of the bully that he's having to deal with, which is this really freakish looking monster.
Yeah.
Also named Gabra.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is like, Gabra's a weird monster, but honestly, he almost stands up with some of the other Godzilla creatures that came afterwards. Now, some of the Godzilla monsters, like Gigan was a pretty awesome monster, but, you know, King Caesar and some of those were kind of strange. I mean, Gabra, so, especially for a film, to be the original monster for this film, and as cheap as this film is, I mean, you could do worse than Gabra. I mean, believe me, he's better than a lot of the Ultraman stuff, man. My God, some of those monsters on Ultraman, and, you know. So Gabra's not a total, I don't think Gabra's a total embarrassment, you know. So.
Well, here's the thing. One thing that I do not understand about Gabra is what in the hell is that noise that he makes?
Oh yeah, it's like some strange like a hyena's kind of laugh through a weird
You know what it sounds like to me? It sounds like I swear to you, one of the first cars I ever owned was a Toyota Corolla, and it went through a period, and I didn't know what was going on, but the starter was going out, and you just had to hit the key just right for it to actually start the vehicle.
Uh-huh.
Well, the noise that car made, that's what he sounds like. That's what Gabra sounds like. He sounds like my green Toyota Corolla when I was in high school trying to start.
You may be close to it. I mean, some Toho employee may have one day been like, hey, there's our sound trying to start his car. Because, hell, I mean, Godzilla's iconic, incredible roar was made by running like a rubber glove over a contrabass or something like that. No, it was just some bizarre way they came up with that amazing roar, that amazing sound that Godzilla makes. But, yeah, unfortunately, they didn't come up with a keeper for Gabra. You know, it was not one of the iconic noises, I'm afraid.
No. And he's kind of freaky, weird looking.
I'll tell you something that's an interesting thing about this film is that the sequence where Godzilla, you know, teaches Minya how to breathe fire, where he tries to get him, and all Minya can blow where the smoke rings, and finally Godzilla has to step on his tail to make him breathe fire. That's new footage, but it's a recreation, almost exact recreation, almost, of the same sequence in Son of Godzilla.
Uh-huh.
And the question that arises is, why didn't they just use that sequence from Son of Godzilla for this film? And I think that the reason is because if you watch the sequence where Godzilla goes through basically the same thing with Minya, where Minya's blowing smoke rings and Godzilla's trying to get him to... There's some scene where Godzilla, talk about tough love, Godzilla's like being really threatening and menacing to her. Like when Minya keeps screwing up and can't breathe fire, Godzilla's even one scene where he kind of raises his fist like he's going to pound him on the head or something. And, you know, it's kind of like Godzilla needs to be wearing like a wife beater, you know, shirt and, you know,
with a cigarette dangling out.
Yeah, and I always kind of picture like Mothra showing up with her social services badge and a clipboard, you know, or something, you know. So I think honestly they don't recreate I think they don't recreate that sequence because Godzilla is actually kind of a bully, and what is the purpose of this film is supposed to be anti-bullying, and so I think they actually filmed it to be a little bit more comical and a little bit more gentler, you know, where Godzilla's not quite the asshole that he is in Son of Godzilla.
It's going to take a while for me to get the image of Mothra as a social worker out of my head.
Yeah, but of all the kaiju, who would be the social worker? But it's the role she was born to play. Yeah, so
I guess you're right.
But that's the only reason I can figure that they didn't just lift that scene too. I mean, why film that anew, you know, when you're basically showing the exact same thing? But
well, here's another thing that. We've talked about coming back to this movie as an adult, and I only saw it as an adult, and only in the past year have I revisited the film after my initial feelings of disgust, anger, and embarrassment when I first caught it in the 90s.
Right.
Well, one of the things that I do admire about this film on a level of filmmaking is how Honda and the scriptwriters very easily and smartly set up why our main character would be so introverted and would be a kid who would push himself into a very imaginative world, because he's doing it to escape this polluted, industrialized, urban. I mean, it's a blighted place. Every place outside that we see is it's industrial. There's factories and railroad tracks. And a smokestack.
These kids play in junkyards, basically.
Yeah, these kids are playing in overgrown fields that they've been able to tear a hole in the fence to get to, and abandoned buildings that honestly are clearly condemned and nobody should be inside.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of rough. looking. And so, of course, that's why a kid like this would retreat into a world of his own imagination. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that is very effective. They set that up very well.
Hi, Smenya.
Hey, come on over here. I won't hurt you.
You won't?
No, don't be afraid.
Thanks for saving me.
Why'd you come here?
I just wanted to see you.
Your folks will get kind of worried, won't they?
I don't think so. They're hardly home any time at all.
Gabra!
Gabra?
Himself! Let's get out of here!
That's Gabra, huh?
Yeah. Isn't he scary?
Do you ever fight?
Guy, no. I'm chicken.
I know how that is.
Why do you say that?
We both got a Gabra.
Yeah.
Let's get into something that is now a real stumbling block for an adult watching this film is our precursor to the Home Alone films, basically.
I'm glad you brought it up in those terms.
And yes. Can I say right now that I don't enjoy the Home Alone films? And so,
I don't think I ever managed to finish the first one, and God knows, I think there were two sequels.
But if you're looking for the seeds of the germs of the idea,
folks, yeah. I have a lot of love for the films of John Hughes. Hey,
I like many.
I was a teenager in the 80s. Believe me, I understand. Mm-hmm. I really, really do. There was a point past which, though, John Hughes had lost it.
Oh, yeah.
And Home Alone is the best point at which to say, you know, he's lost his mind here. Yeah. This is not any good. This is pure silliness. Mm. And there's nothing in Home Alone that you don't know 5 minutes in is going to be in Home Alone.
Yeah. So basically same kind of thing happens to Ichiro, is we have this other subplot of apparently these bank robbers, you know, you can't imagine how they managed to pull off a heist, but once you come to know them, but they do apparently pull down a heist, and they're hiding out in Ichiro's neighborhood. And
it's very bizarre.
Yeah.
Okay, there are two of them. Mm-hmm. You're right. You can't figure out for the life of you how either of these guys, or working in tandem, could have actually planned any robbery whatsoever. So my working
I'm not really sure how they even dress themselves, how they even tie their own shoes.
I'm not altogether sure they could competently pick their own noses. But the thing that I do think, from having watched this film as an adult recently, is that there had to have been a third robber who was murdered during the robbery or died in a horrid accident during the escape, who was the brains of the operation.
Yeah, it was the brains, and you're right. So, because what we were left with was a couple of twisting limbs, and that obviously have no brain to coordinate there. You know, and if it sounds funny, it's not. And that's the problem. Maybe it is to a kid, you know. And I get the thing that we don't want to put anything, you know, this is a gentle, overall pretty gentle film. I mean, it's for little kids. Yeah. You don't want anything too menacing, but it's one of the things that, as an adult, you really just can't get past. It's just, you just wish it wasn't there. This whole subplot of where, for some, you know, reason, it contrives to where they have to take Ichiro hostage.
Yeah.
And he has to outwit them and outsmart them using memories of what he's seen in his dream sequences on Monster Island, you know, and it's never entertaining, and it's never very
it's
funny,
never
and it's certainly never, there's never, and they, and there's never enough, because they're totally so bumbling and so unmenacing, and because it is made to be so harmless to kids, is as an adult, is there is not the any kind of suspense or interest at all to grasp onto in this story, in this subplot there. You know, that doesn't make you just count the seconds till it gets to something else, you know.
Yeah, basically it's almost as if, imagine a small child was being held hostage and was attempting to be menaced by Shemp and Curly.
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to. You know that eventually one of them is going to step on a board with a nail in it and kill themselves.
Yeah.
Or be attacked by their own food. I mean, this is just what that's not what occurs in the film, but honestly, if their storyline had gone on long enough, I'm sure a clam in a bowl of soup would have gotten the best of one of them. So.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. That is one. I agree. Well, let me go. I'll say right here that I'm not going. I've come to bury this film, not to praise it. In the sense, you know, is I'm not going to deviate too far from you. I'm not going to.
Mark Anthony.
Yeah. It's not a good film, and I'm not here to convince people that it is. You know. However, I will say that I think that if you're looking for something to show a young child, you could do a lot worse. You know, I think it's pretty good.
Let us once again bring up Home Alone.
yeah, exactly. I mean, it certainly worked for me as a little kid because, again, I mean, what kid doesn't want to go to Monster Island and, you know, and hang out with Godzilla? And I didn't mind Minya at that age too, you know. I thought like it would be a bad buddying around with Minya, you know. It's just true. I mean, he's the monster. I don't think any Godzilla fan really likes Minya, but probably Godzilla fans with kids probably appreciate Minya a little more as an introduction. I've heard it said before that this film might be the best of the series introduction to if you've got a child of 4 or 5 or something that you're wanting to show, you know.
Well, I could see that easily. Yeah. That would be true.
Yeah, but yes, as an adult to watch it, I mean, the things that I appreciate about it, we were kind of touching on already with the fact that it's not a real sentimental film, you know, it's not an overly sentimental film.
Oh, no,
and
not
I
at
like
all.
That about
and,
it.
And that's a plus.
And that's, I think, a lot of that's due to Ishiro Honda. I think he had that kind of touch, and it's also due to him that it does not shy away from, like we talked about, the bleakness of it. I mean, really, this film is, this may surprise people, but this is the first film since the original Gojira, the original Godzilla film in 1954, to have this much bleak and stark imagery, because most of the run of the Golden Age of Toho films, you know, they were very lush, beautiful films, either in island settings or wherever they were on other planets, you know, there were these beautifully painted, you know, spacescapes and, you know, and just this incredible scenery and beautiful colors. So this is the first film to just kind of have that kind of harsh, stark, you know, examination of Japan since the first Godzilla. Now, of course, quality-wise, the two films are miles apart, you know, miles apart.
I hadn't thought about that, but the kind of the urban blight that this film shows. There is a touch of that in the original black and white movie. Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess you're right.
And like I said, and nothing in between, nothing in any of the Godzilla films in between.
Those are very colorful films. Yeah. Well, the second film, Godzilla Raids Again.
Yeah, was still in black and
still
white.
Still in black and white, but yeah.
Okay. But so I like the fact that the film isn't overly sentimental. I think it's interesting that the film doesn't. I know we don't usually want to talk too much about exactly the endings, or I guess spoil the endings in the. But let's just say that in all, we talked about his plight of being the latchkey kid and the problem with his parents not being there, and you know the kind of things he's having to deal with in his social life is, even though he kind of reaches a personal triumph by what he's learned from watching Godzilla and watching Minya fight back against monsters and standing up to bullies and all that, but overall, the film doesn't have some big light at the end change for his situation. Like an American, I think American version of this, if this same story had been attempted in an American film, there would have been some kind of win the lottery kind of ending. There would have been something to alleviate the bleakness of it. Yeah, there really isn't in this.
There really isn't. The big change in the movie is the change in the little boy's attitude toward his life.
Yeah, exactly. He kind of accepts, and I think that there's two things for that. I think that two reasons for that. I think one is kind of a general Eastern versus Western acceptance of suffering and the harshness of life, you know. I think that there's more in the Eastern acceptance than there is necessarily in the Western, you know, we're chasing our kind of American dream kind of thing.
Well, I think the Western attitude is more of an attempt to overcome and change the nature of the things that are affecting your life, where the Eastern is to kind of be much more of the accepting end of the spectrum. Okay, there are things I can't change and I need to accept them and I need to learn to work with or around them.
Yeah.
And I think you see that in the ending of this film, the attitude change in the main character. So, yeah.
And I think also it's indicative of the fact that I think the Japanese were maybe a little more, gave their audience maybe a little more credit than American productions
because
I see it not just in this film. Well, one thing we'll notice as we're doing this, you know, as we're doing these controversial kaiju films is how many times within this series Toho, and sometimes, like I said, they might have been driven by economics or attitudes of the time, but I think there's, you know, I don't know if you can find another series of films that allowed this many deviations from the norm, you know, this many twistings of the Yeah, because you even look at this film. I mean, this film, All Monsters Attack, you know, we see in Ishiro's room, okay, there's Godzilla toys, you know. It's 10 films into the series where suddenly you're shown this world where either Godzilla is just a part of the pop culture, or is it a world where Godzilla really exists and has appeared before, and it never really tells you. You know, you assume that this is something he's watched Godzilla movies and Godzilla's a pop culture character within a society, you know. But in another film, which we'll talk about another time, there's a boy playing with Godzilla toys in a world where Godzilla really exists, you know. So in this world, we're not really sure which it is because they don't really tell you. But as some people point out, the fact that the use of stock footage works in this film, because if you were a kid that lived in the world and watched Godzilla movies, and this kid, that's the world this kid's lived in, and he's having dreams,
he would dream of the films
that he has seen, which I think is a little bit of a stretch. It's like, okay, like I said, those are the people that go to the lengths to defend the film that I'm not willing to go to. But I like that they're out there. I'm glad somebody's trying to fight for this film, even if it's not me. You know,
I will admit, as much as I am not a big fan of the film Son of Godzilla, the sequence from that film that I would remember back if I were a little kid would be the giant spider fight. So.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because that's bad as hell.
That's pretty awesome, man. You gotta love the Godzilla and the giant spider, you know, especially when the spider stabs him in the eye. That's pretty grim, actually, and it shows that, and they reproduce that in this film, and that's pretty gruesome stuff. So, I think that there's things you can appreciate that the film does, but I think that, you know, I think it's fine for kids. For me, probably, personally, you know, I probably would give it, I'd probably give it a 6.
On the 1 to 10 scale.
On the 1 to 10 scale, I'd give it a 6. A lot of that is, again, kind of appreciating. I keep thinking, you know, if they had filmed all new monster footage, how much would that have improved this film? And I think it would have improved it quite a bit. I still don't know if it wouldn't have still probably made it like a really good film. But I think, you know, if they had just not had to have resorted to the stock footage, I think it would held up in people's eyes a lot better now. If they had filmed new fights with new monsters in that place, then I think that it would be a lot better thought of now. So I think the use of stock footage is a real detriment to people who are lifelong Godzilla fans or you have watched all these films now. It's hard to go watch a film that's just so much of what you've seen before. But like I said, I give it a 6, but it's not one that... I mean, it's certainly one of the Godzilla films I've watched the least in my life, I probably wouldn't return to it again unless either I was showing it to a very young child, or if, you know, every 10 years or so, I'll just go through a chronological just rewatch of the whole series, and then I might throw it in. But otherwise, it's not one that I'm going to get a random craving to, you know, to check out.
Well, actually, I go back and forth between giving this thing a 3 or a 4. Not a fan of it. Don't enjoy it all that much. I can admire aspects of it, but overall not that much of a fan. It's too much Mina, not enough Zilla.
I understand.
And that's really what it boils down to. In a lot of ways, this is a kind of a Mina movie, and I'm not a big fan of that character. I did enjoy the return of the character in many years later, shall we say, in another film that we may end up talking about later on.
Right.
But, definitely not my favorite Godzilla film.
Yeah, so. For Kiss fans, this is their Unmasked, you know. This is probably Toho's, this is their Kiss Unmasked, you know. Because I was thinking of, believe it or not, I was actually finding parallels in the fact that, you know, Kiss kind of reached that point in their career when, you know, because they did the Kiss comic book and they did the Kiss dolls and the Kiss Meets the Phantom. Suddenly, they were noticing adults bringing their kids to their concerts, and it really, I think, affected a lot of what they put in their music and how they went about their music. And I think that's why you suddenly got that stretch of, like, Dynasty Unmasked and, you know, just the really bad, you know, albums that followed up those first really hard rockin', and suddenly they're... audience wasn't like, you know, teens and young adults that were smoking weed out there in the auditoriums. It was, you know, it was their audience were kids, you know,
Plus I think one thing that happens when you reach a certain level of success, and that's odd that we're finding a parallel between Godzilla and Kiss, but maybe not that weird, is that once you reach a certain level of success, you realize that your reach was wider or larger than you thought. And suddenly you are taking a look at your audience. In other words, the audience is looking at you, and suddenly you're looking at your audience.
Yeah.
And you're realizing, oh, this isn't a one-way street. I'm not just putting this out there and they're soaking it up. they're looking back at me, and I'm being affected by who they are, yeah. what they are, what they think, what they yeah. expect of me, mm-hmm. and therefore certain things alter. And there's no way around it. If you reach right. a certain level of success, mm-hmm. that's going to creep in. It's not necessarily a bad thing. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, sometimes it can be a very, very good thing, mm-hmm. but it does change things. Yeah. Plus, there's also that fact that you just change as you get older.
Yeah.
You know, when you are... When you're 35, writing about that hot chick that you couldn't get when you were in high school is really kind of doofus. Time to move on, write some other shit. And you either change your art as you yourself change, or you run the risk of becoming kind of a joke.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what you can see here is if this film in the Godzilla series is the biggest change up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. It was the first
big serious, yes, Godzilla had already started to become more of a sympathetic, more of a heroic right. character, but this is the first just real deviation, left turn to another totally direction altogether. Yeah.
If you're going to do that, what causes that? You've talked mm-hmm. about, the competition from the Gamera films
mm-hmm.
and various other things, the desire to make these films cheaper mm-hmm. because the profits weren't as high in the mm-hmm. in the last few films. So if you want to make as much money, you've got to make the film for less. But there's also that fact that this is 15 years later.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've been doing this group of people have been doing these things now for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And not just the 10 Godzilla films, this was the 10th, but all those films interspersed in between.
True, because at that was the point, they reached a point where they pretty much stopped making anything but Godzilla films from this point on, just about. Even that, there were still a few fantasy films, but you're right, during that golden age, I mean, they'd make a Godzilla film, then they'd make two or three other giant monster, science fiction, horror films, all that kind of thing.
Things like Atragon,
Matango,
the Mysterians, things mm-hmm. like that. So,
yeah.
You're talking about a lot of different films being made by this group of people, and mm-hmm. the longer you do something, the longer you're that creative at that level, mm-hmm. the more you change your outlook on your output and your outlook on yeah. your creativity as well. And so mm-hmm. things alter and change, and sometimes...
And some fatigue kind of factors.
Exactly.
In after a while. Yeah, and I think we're looking at a lot of that here. I mean, again, like I said, they're major special effects. Guy had already kind of moved on to, he was wanting to move in another direction. He was wanting to conquer the land of TV, and...
And eventually his production company did.
Yeah, I'll say this too. This is just because not intentionally, but I've actually just had been watching in the last few weeks Ultra Q, which was the very first series that Tsuburaya's team did before they did, is the precursor to Ultraman. Now it's not, doesn't center around, Ultraman was still the first that centered around the superhero character we think of that, grows giant, fights the giant monsters. Ultra Q was actually more inspired by Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. It was kind of a monster.
I've never seen any of that. I need to.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. And once again, it's a good example watching it of how much Japanese, filmmakers and even for the TV audience kind of gave their audience more credit, trusted their audience to go with them when they went with different deviations. Because if you watch the Ultraman series, everybody knows the formula for the Ultraman series, which is generally, giant monster attacks, Ultraman fights him all the way up to the very end, Ultraman suddenly remembers he has a ray that can destroy everything, and so just before he runs out of energy, he blasts, you think every episode's like that. But then when you actually go to watch the series, the first three or four episodes are like that. Then they start doing weird things with the episodes, and you get some really wonky, strange takes on that, and some episodes where even Ultraman and his people kind of almost come off as like the bad guys and the monsters are the sympathetic characters. While Ultra Q is even more stranger because it's kind of a monster of the week thing too. You do have some characters who are continuing characters in each episode, but there's even a couple episodes where they're not even in it. And boy, you want to talk about some strange episodes and some just, very surreal episodes, very strange things, very entertaining watching, very strange TV show. And
Ultra Q,
yeah.
Like I say, I need to check that series out.
It was never shown, as far as I can tell. Supposedly it was dubbed, or at least a few episodes were dubbed into English, but nobody's ever been able to show, we don't think that they were ever shown anywhere in America. Like, they were about to be shown, and for whatever reason, just because American television right about that time was going to all color, and they just stopped being interested in a black and white TV series, because Ultra Q's black and white.
Okay.
So they say that they found, I think, the audio tapes of where it was dubbed in English, but it's never been shown that way. So the DVD that Shout Factory's put out is all Japanese language with subtitles. But great quality, looks fantastic, and again has that some of those great Japanese the special effects, because Tsuburaya's company was doing the effects. And but just, yeah, some very, very strange ideas and bizarre ideas for plots and stories. So, you know, it's you know, it's definitely, you know, that's kind of thing, that's kind of where his focus was. And so, yeah, I think the Godzilla series really was kind of tired, was starting to get tired at this point. You know? But doesn't mean there wasn't still fun to be had, as we will see.
As we will see in future episodes of this, yes. Yeah. So, I guess that will wrap it up, unless you've got anything else.
I don't believe so. I don't think that's got it. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Let us know. People can comment on your episodes, Bloody Pit episodes, on your
blog. Right there on the blog in the comments, or they can write to thebloodypit@gmail.com. The Bloody Pit all rammed together as if it were one single word. The inner tubes.
Yes.
Yeah, drop us a line. If you've got any comments to make, we will be doing at least three more of these over the next several months. Mm-hmm. We've not really got it all nailed down.
Right.
You probably see one Godzilla episode of the Bloody Pit a quarter.
That's kind of what we're thinking. Maybe one every quarter there. So, I hope you enjoyed it. We've had fun doing it.
If you like, I say anything to say, any comments on Godzilla movies, good or bad, let us know.
I understand you just did another Bloody Pit episode with
John Hudson,
right?
Got another one in the pipeline. The next episode of the Bloody Pit is going to be once again John Hudson's returning to the co-hosting chair, and with me he'll be talking about John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13.
Oh, good choice. Good choice.
Hudson and I are hoping to do a few more podcasts in the new year.
Mm-hmm.
He sat down with me for the episode on Rock and Roll High School and our very well received episode on Kolchak the Night Stalker, and so he and I hoping to kind of zig around. We may do another John Carpenter film or two in the in the new year, but looking forward to letting everybody in on our conversation about the second, or is it really the first, John Carpenter film, Assault on Precinct 13, and we will talk about that in the next episode. But next month, Troy and I will be back in the Nashy Cash chair to be talking about, a kind of Nashy kids movie in a way.
Yeah, that's true. My Friend the Vagabond we're going to be doing as our Nashy Cash 49. So, yeah, and then you may or may not have a Bloody Pit Christmas-themed another episode coming this. I know you're hoping in December.
Fingers crossed
that maybe you have something going on. But so, yeah, keep up with the Bloody Pit. Keep up with Nashy Cast.
And
keep up with Rod and I, as long as it doesn't reach the stalking level.
Yes, really, please. I mean, enough of that stalking, for God's sake. I can't believe you people the way you are.
I know I've had to install a guard at my front gate and drive.
The electrified fence has kept a lot of people out.
It's hard to keep the oil on my battlements boiling, you know, there. So it's,
I just pictured you as Gomez Adams. Well, anyway, folks, thank you very much for listening. And we will talk to you again next time. My name is Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And don't let the big G step on you.
That's right.
anything you want to, huh?
You better not play in there. It's closed.
Oh, I know how to get in there.
You might get in trouble, Zero.
Everybody goes in there to play all the time.
I can't. Mother says to come home. You better not go in there. Ichiro, you better get out.
Uh-oh.
You shouldn't go in there.